This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Dora Amelon grew up with her parents at a quiet vacation resort in Belgium in the 1930s. It was a blissful existence that was harshly interrupted when Nazi Germany invaded the country in 1939. Dora was forced to escape to France, leaving her parents behind. But rather than live in hiding, she served as a nurse to young Jews who were forced into Nazi internment camps. She survived and is still living in France today. Dora's incredible story is the inspiration for a new dance performance from award-winning choreographer Bill T. Jones. His work has explored important social issues, including racism and the AIDS epidemic. Bill T. Jones has won 2 Tony Awards. He's won a Kennedy Center Honor, a National Medal of Arts, and received a MacArthur Genius Award. There are more, but we want to get into the conversation. So his piece is called Analogy Dora Tramontane. It will be performed tonight and tomorrow at the Durham Performing Arts Center as part of the American Dance Festival. But first, he joins me on the State of Things. Welcome to the program, Bill T. Jones. Good to have you here.
Very good to be here.
Also with us is Bjorn Amelon, Bill's creative collaborator, set designer, and husband, and his mother, Dora Amelon, is the inspiration for this weekend's performance. Bjorn, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Bill, describe this piece for us. Tell us how it came about.
Mm-hmm. Well, the piece is, as usual, me solving problems. And one of the problems was, where was my interest? I love my company. The company is in its 33rd year. But there was this question, why make another dance, which is always the question. And I said to myself and to my company, my interest is literary right now. Reading the work of the great German novelist W.G. Sebald, which writes in his quasi-novelistic historical reportage method, I'm very moved by what he's doing in weaving that which is fictitious and that which is fact. And he also uses photographs. So when you read his books, you're getting a history lesson, but you're looking deeply into the human psyche, and you're thinking about how a novel and how and what a novel is. I was thinking, what about my work? What about my company? How can they be? I could be closer to them in my love for the word. And so they are young dancers, but these young dancers are actually able to speak, and I have encouraged them to speak, and we do it in a very apparent way, which is passing a microphone. So there's complicated stage movement happening with a beautiful decor that Bjorn has designed, with lighting and so on, and even costume change. But you're watching one level of a creative endeavor, which is the way the stagecraft is proceeding, and you're hearing this narrative, which is actually being told by a whole group of people. The narrative incidentally takes the form of an oral history, which is a conversation between me and Dora Amelon.
And that was a conversation that really took place.
Yes, it is. It's how many years ago?
Some 12 or so years
it's
ago.
It's usually 15 years ago we had this talk. I did it because Dora, as many people say, who are children of that period in European history, their parents did not talk as much about that time as they do now when they were growing up. I wanted to make a gift to my companion and his brother, Ronnie. So I wanted Dora to talk me through that period from the 4 years of the war. She was much more generous than that. I sat on that tape, that recording, for quite a few years. Bjorn transcribed it, literally typing out what she and I said. And I realized rather than trying to indulge in a novelistic form like Sebald, why not use Dora's transcript? And that's how we started.
Well, Bjorn, you are a creative collaborator and the set designer for this, but also Dora's mother, the inspiration, son, the inspiration for this. Tell us more about her story. Give us an idea of what was happening in that camp after she was forced to leave Belgium.
Well, she left Belgium. She was 19 when the war started. Her mother died 10 days of cancer, 10 days after the German walked into Belgium, and shortly thereafter she obtained permit to go to the south of France, Vichy, which was the area not occupied by the German until 1942, which had a puppet government obeying the German orders. There were camps that had been, two camps in particular, Gurs and Rivesaltes, which had been created by the French authorities in 1936 to house refugees of the Spanish Civil War. And in those camps, enemy aliens, when the war was declared, were housed. It's so the irony was, of course, that many of those so-called enemy aliens were refugees from Nazi Germany who had fled the regime and who, as my mother says, were much more anti-German than the actual average Frenchman. Most of them were Jews. The conditions in the camp were dire. Mother got to the south of France after a brief stint with an aunt of her who had a farm where they had found refuge. She intended to attend a social workers class. That class was cancelled on the day it was supposed to start by the Vichy authorities, who decreed that such profession was not permitted for Jews. But a woman who spoke at the gathering of that class, a Jewish woman named André Salmon, spoke of those camps and of the help that was needed there. And so Mother volunteered, and according to what she tells us, the next day or the day after, she went to work into the camp, the first camp, Rivesaltes, where the conditions were extremely dire, malnourishment, appalling hygiene conditions, very hard, tough conditions. They were receiving help from the Quaker organizations as well as the Red Cross and some Jewish underground organizations. At that time, the Jews were not yet entirely underground in southern France. They smuggled, and then deportations began. And they were able to smuggle children and some adults out, help in various ways. She worked in the camps until the end of 42, i.e. for a year and a half or so, at which point the camps were pretty much emptied and everybody was deported.
And she herself contracted typhoid, is that right?
During that time, she did contract typhoid, but returned after a few weeks in a hospital to continue the work.
So, Bill T. Jones, when you decided to sit down with Dora and collect this oral history, was it your intention at the time to somehow translate this into dance?
Not at all. No, no, truly, this was a domestic affair. This was, I think this is what causes Jed Wheeler of Peak Performances, who was our lead commissioner on this, to say that he felt that this work was actually about my relationship with Bjorn. I had sat with the Amelons. His brother Ronnie works at UNESCO. He's a translator, and he works in the press corps there. Very intelligent people who argue about in different languages about grammar. They're very well read. They love each other, but there's constantly a kind of verbal fisticuffs going on, Dora included. And in all of this, I was sort of amazed at these different levels of history that I had privilege of sitting with. And I wanted to do my part in capturing Dora's participation in it, so it would be a gift to her sons. But no, I hadn't been thinking of it as in my work.
And I'm sorry, but this piece is actually part of a trilogy too, right?
It is the first section of what I hope to be a trilogy.
All right. So then when did it occur to you that this might be a dance, and how do you make that translation? I'm always curious about how you take a thing like a word and turn that into movement, and whether or not that's in the way.
Actually, we don't try to turn words into movement. Actually, they are running on they're oftentimes running on parallel tracks. And my pieces are challenging because a person has to be able to split their focus and watch a complex stage language and choreographic language while holding a narrative that's being moved around. This is why it is not a sentimental work about the Holocaust. It's actually it is a puzzle, and it is something that demands engagement on a lot of levels. The heart is satisfied by the work, and many people go immediately to the heart place because it's a very touching thing. But there are others, maybe, who want to see this weaving, and it is weaving that is going on between the literal in the movement and the literal in the text, and vice versa.
Is it Bjorn, go ahead.
And something about the title, analogy, implies that which Bill speaks, because one of the references, obviously it's a trilogy, so the analogy will run through the three part of the work of which this is the first, but there's that analogy between the movement and the oral, the soundscape that one hears, and that reconciling of the seemingly disparate but greater than the sum of their parts elements.
I contend that if you turned off the sound, it would still be an exciting theater experience.
Part of that theater experience would be the set design. And so how do you then manage those parallel tracks as a set designer? What do we see on stage?
Well, one of the tensions we have sometimes, Bill and I, is that as a set designer over the last years for the company, Bill likes me to provide him with something that can give a framework, an architecture to the movement that he has yet to create, whereas I always feel that my set design needs to be response to what he will create. It's hard to conceive of a set before the work is done. But early...
May I interrupt you?
Please.
You never report this part. I say a set design should stimulate or encourage choreographic investigation.
Right.
So that's why you don't want to wait until the choreography is made and then put a set on it.
So you see the discussions we are having.
Yeah.
One of the early elements that Bill suggested that I create were shapes that might be evocative in some form or manner and can create, because Bill does not like set elements to be decorative, purely decorative elements that are like jewelry on the stage, but rather he wants the set always to interact and as something that the dancers can work with, in, or around. I created three shapes, abstract shapes, that allowed the dancers and Bill to choreograph various configuration and be their house, a barrack, an enclosure, or just abstract shape. And ultimately, the last element in the set was this idea to make something akin to a photographic studio psych, I think it's called.
Cyclorama, yes.
Cyclorama.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking that stripping the theater and creating this light gray cyclorama in a stripped environment would create a heightened area for the dance of memory, which is basically what this dance is, to find place in.
So that gives energy to the dancers as well as the audience. We're all sort of drawing from this and applying ourselves to it.
And being plunged into this world within what is currently the normal proscenium world.
And the normal proscenium world is its own problem, because we as an audience becomes very complacent.
Right.
So we are finding ways, and the way Bjorn has arranged the floor. The floor starts on the floor, moves away from the audience, and goes up into the rafters. It's open on the sides, and the sound design also, we're striving for an immersive experience, although you're sitting in your chair. I think we're moving in that direction, and we're having some success with it.
You talked about the sound design, the music. There is original music in this, but you're also taking songs from a lot of songbooks, including the French popular songbook and the classical works. Maybe you could talk a little bit about how you worked music into this piece.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I say, W.G. Siebold's The Immigrants is just studded with all sorts of references to songs of the 19th century, 20th century, and as far going into the 1980s. That was my inspiration, how he can drop an indication of a song. Dora speaks about her youth, and she speaks about something like someone like Charles Trenet, who was the last summer of her, or before the war, and the song that we used in the show, I believe, was his hit at that time.
Would that be Le Soleil et la Lune?
Is that true?
Yeah. Le Soleil a rendezvous avec la Lune in 1939. Mother says it is the last song that she danced to, the last dance they had on the near the boardwalk in Belgium on the seashore as the war, before the war broke on.
And here it is.
Sur le toit de l'hôtel où je vis avec toi, quand j'attends ta venue, mon ami, quand la nuit fait chanter plus fort et mieux que moi, tous les chats. Que dit-on sur les toits, que répètent les voix de ces chats qui s'ennuient, des chansons que je sais, que je traduis pour toi, les voici, les voilà. Le soleil est rendez-vous avec la lune, mais la lune n'est pas là et le soleil attend. Ici bas souvent chacun pour sa chacune, chacun doit en faire autant. La lune est là, la lune est là, la lune est là, mais le soleil ne la voit pas. Pour la trouver, il faut la nuit, il faut la nuit, mais le soleil ne le sait pas, et toujours lui, le soleil est rendez-vous
avec
la
lune. This sets up a pretty jaunty and this kind of, I described as blissful, I certainly wasn't there, but this experience of living in pre-Nazi.
And a 19-year-old girl.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I sometimes forget that Dora was, she was up kicking up her heels and dancing to this. The other musical area that is very important to me was there even before Dora came into the picture was the leader of Schubert. I'm a great fan of Schubert. And I had, in my solo show some years ago, I used a number of his lieder. One that I was wanting to use was Nachtstück. I'm not sure who the poem is by. It's not Goethe, is it?
I don't remember.
But it tells of an older man, described an older man who moves out in this moonlight. And he is holding a lyre, a harp. And, of course, it's an allegory for age and time and death coming on. And it's German lieder and a story in which the Germans play a very dark part.
We have a little bit of that as well. Just in the music alone, the topographic relief in yes. in those two songs is pretty incredible.
It's striking, isn't it? You have to realize that my aesthetic was shaped in a way, if you think of a Rauschenberg combine. You know, Robert Rauschenberg, the great...
I don't know. You'll have to describe it for
me. Rauschenberg is one of the leaders of the pop art movement, and his method was to take things from print media, from pop culture, from sculpture, and he was the original mashup artist, you know. So he made these huge, very ambitious paintings, and he was the driving force aesthetically for a while in Merce Cunningham's work. Mm-hmm. So Rauschenberg combine is a particular kind of crazy, by the seat of your pants kind of construction, which he threw things together in a very intuitive way. He had a great color sense, a great sense of line and weight and balance, and therefore the experience always keeps you as an observer quite back on your heels. Mm. What's going on here? Right. How do I get in? And how do I make sense of it? It doesn't spoon feed you what its meaning is. That's how sound works in this. There's also straight up pop and hip hop beats in this thing as well. And our vocabulary cycles through several styles of movement. I have a fantastic company.
Fantastic stuff. Wish I had more time, but I appreciate you spending this time with us. Bill T. Jones, an award-winning choreographer, Bjorn Amelon is creative director and set designer for the Bill T. Jones Arnie Zane Dance Company. Thank you both very much for being here.
Thank you. It's a great honor.
Thank you very much.
You want to see more about the performance at the Durham Arts Center as part of the American Dance Festival? You can go to our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, the music of Asheville's Three Davids. Stay tuned.